We are continuing with our look into Proverbs, and I need to put a disclaimer, a warning. This is not going to focus a lot on going through a number of Proverbs like in previous weeks. We've been looking at a topic before, and this morning we're going to look at an idea that is reflected in a number of different Proverbs, but I think is best illustrated for us this morning through a story. In fact, it's an extended chain of events that happened in the nation of Israel. When we come to Proverbs, we have a number of different, and I don't want to say commands, it's pieces of advice. But all of us have probably had someone in our life that when they gave advice, it felt like a command. You know, sometimes it's a parent, or it's a, you know, an in-law. You know, when a father-in-law or a mother-in-law says something, there can be that pressure to, especially when you're just married, to do what they say and take the advice as a command. But I think all of us have, and it's in some area of our life. We don't like to do what we're told, especially if someone, you know, that just, and they may be a legitimate authority figure or not, but if someone tells us what to do, there's within us that inner compulsion of, yeah, but I don't necessarily want to do it that way, or I kind of have my own ideas, thank you very much, or who are you to tell me that I have to do this or that I have to do that? And see, when it comes to God's commands, and God does have a number of commands for us through the scriptures, even with him, we can get a little defensive. Our spine stiffens. You know, not when we're needing direction, like when you're lost. If you're lost and you go to someone and ask, you know, how do I get to, and they tell you what to do, you welcome it because, well, you need direction. You need that instruction. You want it. But do any of you have someone when you're driving, they know a better way to get there? And they're very free to tell you, oh no, take this, it's a shortcut, trust me. And inside you have to, yeah, but I have my own way of getting there. I like my way better. All of us have an aspect to us where we want to do what we want to do, when we want to do it, and who we want to do it with. We like to be the captain of our own ship, so to speak. And Proverbs, one proverb in particular, speaks to some of this, and it's Proverbs 14:12. It's a proverb that's probably fairly familiar. You may know it in a different translation, but the NLT says it this way: there is a path before each person that seems right, but it ends in death. In other words, what the author of this proverb, Solomon, is saying is that in our moral decisions, not about what you're going to eat for breakfast, but in your moral decisions, how you treat other people, there is usually a way forward that we see, that we like, that we want, but will lead us to negative consequences. And to illustrate this, again, we're not going to look at Proverbs this morning. We're going to look at a chain of events that's recorded in the book of Judges. And this, it's three chapters I'm going to cover this morning in telling the chain of events. So if you want to try to follow along with it, you can turn to Judges chapter 19. Now, just as you're turning there, if you want to, I'm just going to kind of tell the story of what happened. To give us the context, if you're not familiar with the period of the Judges, at that time there was no king in Israel. About 400 years before the chain of, or two, about 300, sorry, 300 years before the chain of events we're about to look at, the 12 tribes of Israel had gone into the promised land under the leadership of Joshua. And the 12 tribes kind of functioned as, if you know your American history, kind of like the 13 colonies before independence. They were all kind of equal to each other. They all kind of cooperated and worked together, but I mean, the governor of Pennsylvania had no authority over the governor of Maryland. They were equals. And so they worked together as equals, but there was no central unifying leader of those 13 colonies because, again, they were too happy with the king of England. The 12 tribes kind of function in this way. I mean, the king, the one who was to be their authority, was God himself. I mean, God had given them a law, a covenant to follow. But the 12 tribes largely functioned independent of one another at this time. But the people of Israel were kind of like you and me. They didn't like to be told what they were supposed to do. And so the book of Judges records a number of cycles where the people would rebel against the instructions, the commands God gave them in the covenant. Because of that, God would withdraw some of his covenant blessing from them. One of the tribes or two of the tribes would face some oppression from a neighboring people group. After a period of time, they'd get tired of that oppression and go, wait a second, God had told us that if we're following him, we won't experience this. We recognize we haven't been following him. God, help us, and God would send a deliverer, a judge, to like Samson or like Ehud or Gideon or Deborah to deliver the people from that oppression. But then another generation would go by and the people would forget about God and kind of drift back towards the gods of the peoples around them, and the cycle would start over. The cycle is kind of like one that you've likely experienced. I know I've experienced it. I do something wrong. I suffer a consequence for it. I recognize that consequence is having an impact on my life in my relationship with the person that I've wronged. I need to go to them and say, sorry, help, or I may need help to get out of the situation I've put myself in. I get a break. Someone helps, you know, and delivers me from whatever that is. And I make a promise to myself, I'll never do that again. Have you ever made that promise to yourself? I'll never do that again. I'll never, you know, go into that place again. I'll never, you know, go back to that relationship. Or, and a week later, a month later, a year later, you've done it again. You've just followed the same cycle that the nation of Israel did, recorded in the book of Judges. It's a cycle that's just part of the consequence of our sin. Well, see, in the culture we live in today, we live in a culture that says, do what you want, when you want, with who you want. Who should tell me? Who should tell you what to do, what's right? Be your own authority. Again, just like the time of the judges, there's a line, and we'll look at it again, but the book of Judges ends with this line. In that day, in those days, there was no king, and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. See, this ties to this proverb. Doing what's right in our own eyes. Proverbs 14:12, there is a path before each person that seems right. It's right in their eyes, but it leads to death. And if we struggle to believe that, here's where Judges 19 through 21 comes in. I warn you, this is a segment of Scripture that one scholar has called the sewer of Scripture. It is the point where this scholar's opinion, the nation sunk to their absolute lowest level. And this is a story we're going to look at. So if you have your Bibles open, we're going to start at Judges 19. If you don't, that's fine. I'm just going to tell you the chain of events as they happen. There was a Levite. Now, a Levite was one of the tribes that they were responsible for caring for the tabernacle. They were responsible for teaching the people how to live in covenant with God. They were to be kind of the spiritual caretakers, the shepherds, the priests of the nation. A Levite from a northern area called Ephraim. He took a concubine, a young woman, who was from Bethlehem, which was in the south of Judah. Now, if you're not familiar with what a concubine is basically a woman who does not have the status of a wife, but is a combination between a servant and a sexual partner. Does not have the status of wife, is essentially property. culturally, under the covenant law, concubines were not to be taken under God's law. But concubines were very part of the culture of the nations surrounding the tribes of Israel. So here we have a Levite taking a woman as a concubine. After some time, don't know why, the concubine became very upset with the Levite. She cheated on him. He found out, got angry. She decides to run home. But 4 months later, the Levite decides, well, wait a second, this isn't working. I want my concubine back. So whether he knew where she was or just figured where else is she going to go, he travels into the south, into the area of Judah, to Bethlehem, goes to the family house. The father of the concubine finds her there. Father sees him, welcomes him into his home, just basically gives him a feast for 3 days. Fourth day, Levite's getting ready to leave with the servant and the donkey that he brought with him and leave with his concubine to go back home. And the father goes, no, just wait. Just wait a little bit. Here's some more food. Let's eat more. Let's drink more. And the Levite says, okay, fine. And it gets too late in the day to start out. And so the fourth day passes. Fifth day, finally, the Levite's like, I've got to go. He's telling people, get ready. The father again is, no, just wait. And, here, have some lunch. Just have some lunch before you leave. The Levite says, okay, has lunch. But then they set out in the afternoon. Well, it's too long a journey to make it in one day when you start in the afternoon. It's approaching evening as they're traveling along the road, and the servant goes to the Levite and says, well, let's stop in Jebus, which you know better as Jerusalem. But Jerusalem at that time wasn't occupied by the tribe of Judah. It was still occupied by the Jebusites, a Canaanite people, a people that were functionally enemies of the tribes of Israel. And so the Levite says, no, let's not stay there. It won't be safe for us. They're not our people. Let's push through, and we'll go a few miles further. And they stopped in the town, the city of Gibeah, which was of the tribe of Benjamin, one of the tribes of Israel. It's my own, it's our own people. They're like cousins. So they get to the Gibeah at about evening, and they go to the center square. Now, in those days, there's no Motel 6, there's no Best Western, there's no hotels to stay at. What you did if you were a traveler and looking to stay over in a town is basically you went to the city square and you started just basically unpacking your camping gear, getting out your bedroll or whatever. And what was to happen, the laws of hospitality culturally, and this is not just the people of Israel, but of the entire area, is that if you were of that town and you saw someone unpacking their sleeping bag to sleep under the stars, you were supposed to go and invite them into your home, give them a meal, care for their animals. And nobody's doing this for the Levite and this concubine and the servant. People are just passing them by. Until finally an old man is coming from the field. And he sees the Levite and he goes, oh, has no one invited you in? He's like, no. And he's like, well, where are you going? He's like, well, I'm coming from Bethlehem, but I'm going to the hill country of Ephraim. And the old man goes, well, that's where I'm from. So they've got some common connection. And he welcomes him in and he gets a meal going. And this is where the story turns. And I warn you, the next number of minutes are going to be ugly beyond extreme. As they're eating the meal, troublemakers, some translations call it some of the wicked men of the city, come around the house, and they start demanding that the old man throws the Levite out to them so they can sexually assault him. I want to be clear here. This is not for some kind of gratification. This was to humiliate the Levite. This was to send a message through him to the people around. Don't come here. We don't like strangers. This is a practice that is well documented in the Canaanite peoples around at this time. In fact, it's the same practice that the people of Sodom practiced back in the days of Lot in Genesis. This was a typical, usual Canaanite practice. You're a stranger. We don't want you here. And this is what the Canaanite peoples would do. But now, this is a tribe of Benjamin doing this. The old man, he's wanting to honor the laws of hospitality. It's like the Levite's his guest. He says, no, don't do this. Look, I have a virgin daughter, and this man has a concubine. We'll give them to you. And when the old man says that, the Levite takes his concubine and basically shoves her out the door. They close the door behind her, and they leave her to the mob for the night. The next morning, the Levite opens the door, probably quite cautiously. And he finds his concubine lying dead at the doorstep. So he takes her, puts her body on his donkey, and continues his journey home. When he gets home, probably the rage has been building up in him, but he gets home, he says, this cannot go unaddressed. Justice has to be done. So he decides to write a letter to the tribal leaders of Israel, to the 12 tribes, 12 letters, documenting, this is what happened to me in Gibeah. This is what happened to me amongst the tribe of Benjamin. But he doesn't stop there. He takes the body of his dead concubine and cuts it into 12 pieces. 12 pieces, 12 tribes. One piece for each letter. And so he sends them off. The leaders get a piece of mail that they would never expect. Grabs their attention. They read the letter, and the tribal leaders start talking amongst themselves, and they meet together and go, how can this be? I mean, how can we have sunk so low? How can our nation have sunk to this point? And they decided that something needed to be done. An example needed to be made so that this would never again happen within the nation of the tribes of Israel. And among their decisions they made is they made all the men who, I mean, they gathered basically 400,000 soldiers at a meeting. What's going to be done? And they had everyone made a vow. We will never give our daughters in marriage to anyone of the tribe of Benjamin. And so the soldiers from all of the tribes except Benjamin gathered, because they went to the tribe of Benjamin, the leaders, and said, look, hand over the men of Gibeah so we can execute them. They deserve to be killed for what they've done. And the tribe of Benjamin went, well, wait a second. Look, you don't have authority over us. They're our people, not your people. We'll decide what needs to be done. And they wouldn't hand them over. And this instigated the first civil war within God's people, tribes of Israel. Tribe of Benjamin were known as skilled warriors. And so even though they're vastly outnumbered, the first day they held off the other tribes, killing tens of thousands. Next day, same thing. So a total of about 40,000 soldiers of the tribes of Israel died in those first 2 days of fighting. Day three, the leaders of the other tribes, the 11 tribes, use a military strategy, and they trick, ambush the soldiers of Benjamin and wipe them out, except for 600 who were able to kind of run away and get to a remote, well-defensible area. But 3 days of fighting had just kind of created a bloodlust within the 11 tribes and the soldiers, and they went through the entire region of Benjamin and killed every man, woman, child, and animal. And when that kind of dissipated and the bloodlust settled down, they went, what have we done? We've just wiped out an entire tribe of God's people. There's no one left. And then one person went, well, wait a second, there's the 600 who ran away and they got away and they're up in that defensible, that remote area. And it's like, well, that's fine, but we made a vow that we wouldn't give our daughters in marriage to anyone from the tribe of Benjamin. So great, there's 600 men that are left, but that's not going to do them any good. Their tribe is finished. And someone else got this idea. Wait a second. Is there any community, is there any town, is there any city that didn't send soldiers to fight? They didn't obey the summons to come and defend the honor of Israel from what the men of Gibeah had done. And they did a survey and they said, wait a second. Anyone here from Jabesh Gilead? Silence. Okay, asking again, anyone here from Jabesh Gilead? Silence. So the leaders and the people, they decide, well, Jabesh Gilead needs to be punished for not answering the summons. So tell you what we'll do, and we'll save the tribe of Benjamin. We'll kill all the men of Jabesh Gilead and take the women and the girls, and we'll give those to the soldiers of Benjamin. So they do that. But there's only 400 women who fit the criteria to be given as wives for the soldiers of Benjamin. So the leaders take the 400 women and they go to where the men of Benjamin are hiding out, and they send kind of a peace delegation, say, look, we went too far. It's safe. You can come back down. We won't do anything to you. Look, we even brought you 400 wives. And for the 200, and I don't know how they kind of, chose who was going to get a wife or not. Scripture doesn't say. But the leader said is, look, we know there's 200 who you don't have a wife yet. And so someone else has got an idea. There's a festival in Shiloh, a community that was nearby. And at a festival, anyone here, I kind of remember maypole dancing or it's a community where, in this case, all the women at Shiloh, all the unmarried women of Shiloh would come out and do a dance as part of a festival celebrating God. And the leaders said to the 200 soldiers of Benjamin who hadn't got a wife yet, said, look, when the women come out to do their dance, you hide in the vineyard, and when they come out, you rush out, grab one, and run away, and we'll intervene for you. We'll go to the fathers and the brothers and say, look, it's like, you know what we happened, and there's 200 men, they didn't have a wife, and we needed to make this right. So look, you didn't break your vow, you didn't give them to Benjamin. Just let it go. And that's what happened. And that's where the book of Judges ends. In those days there was no king, and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. Now you may wonder, well, that was a happy, encouraging, uplifting story. I'm so glad I came to church this morning. There is a path before each person that seems right, but it ends in death. See, the frightening truth above any of the individual actions or events of the chain of events that I just recounted to you, above any one of those actions, the real frightening truth underlying all of that is that at no point in that story is there someone who didn't think that what they were doing was right. And you maybe go, wait a second, there's some horrific things that went on in that story. You've got to be kidding me. It's easy for us to judge when we read it from the outside and say, the Levite was wrong for taking a concubine, and she cheated on him, that was wrong, and what the men of Gibeah did, how can you possibly justify that? I'm not justifying the actions as right. All I'm saying is, let's put ourselves inside the story for a minute. The Levite decides to take a concubine. He doesn't want to have a wife. He just goes, you know, everyone else does it around me. Why not? I mean, if you go on the inside, you go, well, you can justify it. It can seem right in your own eyes. This woman, she's not given the status as a wife, which is supposed to happen under the law, from someone who's a Levite. He's supposed to defend the law to the people. Now, whether that's the reason she got angry with him or not, I don't know. But, say, women who are here, if you had someone who was basically using you, but not giving to you, not investing in you, not granting you full status, culturally, societally, relationally, think you'd be a little upset with them? I'd hope so. I mean, as a father, if someone treated one of my girls like that, better hope Mama Bear gets there before me. The concubine runs home. The Levite decides to go back and get her. Well, that seems right. They go to leave. They get to Gibeah. The old man. Again, we don't get this in our culture, our society, but if you've traveled in the Middle East or if you've traveled to other cultures, you know there's societies where hospitality is king. There is no higher value. And if you're in someone's home, you are obligated to defend them to the nth degree. For the old man to offer his daughter and this concubine to us seems horrific. In the culture, in the time, could seem and was completely justifiable. I'm not saying it's right, just that you could rationally go, I can't give him up. My daughter and this concubine are lesser culturally. The men of Gibeah. I'm not defending their actions. Don't hear that. In a society where you were, 5 miles down the road is a people group who want you dead. Or they're afraid for their lives. What's a way to find out if they're weak? You send a spy. How do you defend yourself against spies? You ruthlessly eliminate any stranger in your midst. How do you keep strangers from coming to your town? You build for yourself a reputation where no stranger will ever want to stay in your town. There is a way that seems right. The men of Gibeah, wicked actions. But there's a way that seems right. The Levite then with the concubine, he cuts her into pieces. Well, I mean, sending a letter. How many of you ever sent a letter to your representative in government? Anyone ever sent a letter? No. Oh, one. Did it work? Did it do anything? Did you expect any response? Yeah. Right? When you sign a petition, petitioning our government, do you really have a strong sense or this is really going to make a difference? Now imagine if you added a body part to the letter that you sent to your member of parliament. Think it'd get their attention a little more? Maybe not the attention you want. But do you see in the mind of the Levite why this would seem like a logical, rational, even reasonable? Because he wants to see justice done. From the tribes of Israel, the leadership, what Benjamin does, every single step of the way, the people involved were doing what was right in their own eyes. At every point of the chain of events, they did what was right in their own eyes. Now, here's a culture where what the book of Judges says is that everyone lived by the philosophy. Nobody can tell me what to do. I'll decide for myself what's right to do. I can do what I want, when I want, with who I want. I mean, just if you can put up this slide, Ron, just some of the things that we say in our culture today. I'll live my life my way. I'll do what I want, when I want, with who I want. Who are you to tell me what is right? If it feels good, do it. Everything's okay. It's okay as long as nobody gets hurt. That's if you want to kind of feel good about yourself in the midst of it. You know, I can do whatever I want. As long as I don't hurt anybody, it's okay. It doesn't matter. As long as it doesn't hurt anybody. This is a society and judges that lived by this philosophy. And we have a bit of this that we like to live by ourselves. And the reality is, in the real world, this philosophy never works. I mean, if you want to live by this kind of philosophy, there's something that you need. You need to be really rich, and you need to have a good team of lawyers. Because many of you are or have been school teachers. Could you imagine going into your classroom day one? You know, September, I don't know, was it 4th, 3rd of the 4th is the first day of school coming up. First day of school, you go to your class and say, we're going to have a philosophy. This is how my classroom, this is how we're going to operate for the year. Students, do what you want, when you want, do it with whoever you want, as long as you don't hurt anybody. How many days do you expect that that would work before your classroom descends completely into chaos? Would you make it to the afternoon? Parents, grandparents, how would you feel sending your child or knowing your grandchild was going into a class where that was the philosophy? How quick before you'd be making a call to the principal? See, in the real world, this philosophy doesn't work, yet our culture sells it, and it's not just our culture. Let's not blame others before we look into our own hearts and recognize that within each and every one of us, we have an aspect to us that we want to do what we want, when we want to do it, with who we want to do it. And for those of us that, you know, want to feel a little bit better about that, we'll add the, you know, as long as I don't hurt anybody, why not? Just a side note here. And this is a side note. It's an important one, but a side note. And this is for us as followers of Jesus. When we hear this message in our society, or when we hear people talking this way, and it comes in all sorts of different forms. Did you notice what happened to all of the women mentioned in the chain of events that I recounted earlier? Was there one woman who was blessed by that philosophy? There's not one. The concubine's not treated and valued as a wife, as a person. They're thrown out. The concubine and even the daughters threatened to be thrown out to the mob. The 400 women of Jabesh-Gilead are given as property, essentially. Their husbands, fathers, brothers killed. The girls of Shiloh kidnapped, abducted. Why? Because the leaders of their society were going, well, it seems right. That's just Judges 19 through 21. I'm going to ask you to take my word for this one, but you can look at it historically. Any time any society has moved the way towards this philosophy, women have always suffered from it. Always. Women are the one, by and large today, sold in sex trafficking. Women are the ones, even in our own society. Who It's our single moms who are the ones when relationships break up or when kids enter the picture, and whether it's a live-in or a marriage or whatever the case may be, it's women who suffer in our society when I'm going to do what's right. I'm done. If it feels good, it doesn't feel good anymore. I'm out. It's our women, by and large, who always suffer when this philosophy takes hold. Again, this is a side note here, but this is an important one for us as followers of Jesus. We want to be agents of justice in our society. We're called to be salt and light by Jesus. We need to recognize what this kind of thinking does and to root it out first in our own hearts. And then as God leads us, to speak out and advocate for those that suffer from thinking like this. Because we cannot live by what is right in our own eyes without inevitably hurting someone, even if that someone is only us. Now, this is kind of a sermon for another day or another series, but see, what happens if we start to live by what is right in our own eyes? We're acting in our freedom. We're taking the freedom that God has given us to make moral choices, and we're saying, God, I'm going to do what's right in my eyes. I'm going to do it my way. I'm going to do what I want with who I want, when I want. And we take our freedom, and that line of thinking will always lead us into bondage. Real simplistic example, and this is simplistic, I recognize that, but it's just an easy one to illustrate it real quickly, and it's with money. Now imagine you take your money, whatever your income is, and you decide, I'm going to buy what I want, when I want, I'm going to buy with who I want, whenever I want. How quickly will that line of thinking lead you into a debt that all of a sudden you're no longer free to buy what you want, when you want? In fact, you find yourself not being able to buy what you need. Anything that masters us has always begun as an expression of our freedom. That's why this line of thinking is so dangerous. That's why the proverb is so right. There is a path that seems right to us, but it leads to death. See, there's another well-known proverb, and most of you here probably know it or you've heard it before. It's Proverbs 3, 5, and 6. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Do not depend on your own understanding. Seek His will in all you do, and He will show you what path to take. When we rely on our own wisdom, we are fools. When we leave God out of the equation, when we leave God out of the circumstances, when we leave God out of our thinking process, when we leave God out of our choices, we are acting as fools. Because no matter how logical, no matter how rational the decision may be, there's always those times when God goes, there's another way. And it's not necessarily illogical or irrational. It's just different. Because, see, it's so easy for us to be judgmental and negative and harsh about those really wicked, foolish men of Gibeah, or the leaders of Israel. Come on, really? You're going to wipe out a city and give those girls away? Like, you're creating chaos within your nation and just making it worse and worse and worse. Can you understand now why that scholar called that section the sewer of Scripture? In our lives, when we operate by our own, well, what's right in our eyes, we invite chaos into our life. If you want out of the chaos that's in your life right now, in your heart, in your conscience, in your relationship, in your circumstances, don't do what seems right to you. Ask God for wisdom. Lean on His understanding. He's waiting for you to call upon him because he wants to deliver you from whatever the chaos you have. Closing thought. We can often feel like, or we can often be told, do what you want, when you want, with whoever you want, as long as it doesn't hurt someone. May I suggest a different statement for us as followers of Jesus that will help us trust in the Lord with our heart, will help us lean into his understanding. Let's live this way. Do what you want, with who you want, whenever you want, as long as it helps someone. I'm not saying that's what it means to be a Christian. All I'm suggesting is thinking in those terms may help us to act out of God's love rather than of our own selfish impulses. Let's stand and pray as we close. Father God, you've made us to live in relationship with you.